Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Well, we have a full house today. We've got, let me open up the microphones, Aina Nealana. Hello, Aina, how are you?
I'm grand, and yourself, Derek?
I'm very good. And Niall.
No, Hatcher, why were you bold?
Oh, sorry, what?
Were you bold?
Yeah. Always very bold.
Why do you say I'm good? You know, were you a good boy, you're a bad boy. I mean, good is an adjective.
You were. Okay, what would you like me to be then?
You could be grand, you could be well, you could be whatever, but being good, as opposed to being bold.
Aina, I'm good. Now build a bridge and get over it. Niall, how are you?
I'm fantastic, Derek.
Fantastic. And Richard Collins at his home in Malahide. Rich, all good out there?
Yes, I'm still above the ground.
Happy to hear it, Richard. Now, last Monday, Aina, was International B-Day.
That's right, International B-Day.
B-Day. Doesn't sound
B-Day.
Quite right, does it?
Well, it's World B-Day. Yeah, you're double entendre. Ah, people are terrible. Listen, it was International B-Day because that is the day of the birthday of Anton Jansa, who was born on the 20th of May in 1734 in Slovenia. And he was the person who wrote books about this, who actually worked out the job of the Queen, the job of the drones, how it all got together, and wrote two enormous tomes about this. And he actually worked as an apiculturalist in the Habsburg court with Maria Theresa, who was the empress, if you wouldn't mind, of the Habsburg dynasty. The poor man died of typhus at the age of 39.
None of the honey helped him at all.
Well, I mean, typhus is a different thing to eating honey. I mean, it might cure a cold, but I don't think it's going to be fixing you with typhus. Yeah. But I mean, every day should be essentially a day for bees.
Well, we're dedicating a huge chunk of today's programme to bees, you'll be happy to hear. But I want to start today with an email I received after the last episode of Back from the Brink was broadcast on RT television last Sunday week. And you can still get it on the player if you'd like to watch it again, or if you didn't get a chance to see it first time around, that's the RTE player. But at any rate, it says, "Dear Derek and team, I am watching Back from the Brink and I have a couple of questions for you. I know that we humans must not be responsible for exterminating any species or creature, but I wonder, can we make an exception for mosquitoes? Mosquitoes spread malaria, which causes misery and death to many thousands of people every year. So would it not be a good idea to exterminate mosquitoes? Or can you tell me any reason why we should preserve them? And what about wasps? I know that they go from flower to flower, thus pollinating them, and they also like to sting people, which is very unpleasant. I would be very happy to see them disappear. Can you tell me why we should preserve wasps? I hope you don't mind me asking you these questions. Thank you very much for Back from the Brink. It's wonderful. Yours sincerely, Michael Robinson, who's in Portrane in County Dublin. So, Aina, you have the conch. We'll start with you.
Yeah. The impudence of humans to decide or not decide that other species have to justify their existence to us, as if we were some sort of a marvellous super species. I mean, you're doing Back from the Brink, and I know you pick different species at different times to welcome their Back from the Brink, but some of those species were made extinct in various countries by humans who thought it was a good idea to get rid of eagles and birds of prey and things like this, and now wonderful efforts have been made to bring them back from the brink, because suddenly we know more about them and how important they are. Mm. So just because the person who wrote in can't think of any reason, in spite of listening to Mooney Goes Wild for 25 years, why there should be mosquitoes in the world, why there should be wasps in the world, here we go again.
No, he's asking for reasons why we should preserve them.
Mosquito larvae are food for fish. Their adults are food for birds, bats, hummingbirds, dragonflies, frogs. In fact, it's only the female mosquito who takes some mammal blood when it needs to lay eggs. Otherwise, all the time, it's pollinating. Its main food is actually nectar from flowers. So, I mean, there are 3,500 species of mosquitoes. Only 400 of them carry disease. Anyway, and as for the wasps, I mean, wasps are carnivores. All the year long in your garden, they're eating green flies, black flies, white flies, chewing them up, bringing them to feed the young. And it's only...
So then what about the mosquito that spreads malaria?
Well, what about it?
Would you want to get rid of that? Or could you ever see a reason why we should get rid of that? So let me give you some stats. So according to the World Health Organization, in 2022, there were an estimated 249 million malaria cases and 608,000 deaths in 85 countries.
How many deaths have there been last year from people killing other people? and people causing famine to them. You know, I mean, the mosquitoes are carrying a disease and people are dying and there's all this carry on. I mean, people kill other people. And I know we're not getting into politics, but I'm just saying that this thing, there have been plans, loads of plans. I mean, they drained all the European marshes to get rid of their habitat. They have contraceptives for them so that the males are not able to impregnate the females. And, you know, they're working on all of this in lots of places. I mean, we had malaria in Ireland up to the 1600s. The last person to die of malaria was Cromwell. Was Cromwell who got it here. But climate change will affect that as well too. But, I mean, there's 8 billion people on Earth and no one lives forever.
Niall.
It is a very tricky one and all sorts of ethical and moral dilemmas here. Definitely there is a need to reduce the suffering people from malaria. It's a scourge around the world and is a problem. A big part of that is to do with ecosystem breakdown. A lot of that is because natural biodiversity is declining. There aren't such natural controls on mosquitoes. Climate change is causing them to spread. We could be looking again at malaria again being endemic in parts of Europe. It was thought eradicated. But as Aina said there, one of the things is the way that they eradicate these mosquitoes is incredibly destructive. You're destroying whole ecosystems to do that by draining swamps or using massive amounts of chemicals that also affect fish and amphibians and all sorts of other non-target insects. Most mosquitoes species are an annoyance, but they're not dangerous. The ones that carry malaria and other things like dengue fever and so on, they are a problem, but they are part of those natural ecosystems and they do play their own roles. They are important food for birds and fish and so on, as Aina said. And it's all about how could you possibly control them effectively without also destroying
the whole ecosystem. You don't believe we should kill them? There's no argument at all. Would never slap one if it landed on your arm or anything like that?
I think we've all done that. I think that's even just a reaction. But I'm not going to get malaria from one here in Ireland. It's just
no, but if you were travelling abroad, if you were out farting.
I think we have the luxury of trying to avoid being bitten by mosquitoes. I know that for people, and many people, especially in developing parts of the world, it's very hard for them to do that. And it is a problem. You have other issues with other diseases like the tsetse fly and sleeping sickness and so on. Really horrible diseases. But it's really very hard to control those without also destroying other parts of the ecosystem that will have other knock-on effects and really bad consequences for humans as well. So it's not something that we humans can really control to the extent that we can. It's very hard to decide, I'm going to make that species extinct,
right,
and that's how I do it, without causing any other consequences, because you are taking a...
So there's going to be a knock-on effect.
There'll be a knock-on effect, and it's going to be very hard to control that. But also, they can play roles in the ecosystems that we don't even fully appreciate or understand. I think when it comes to the wasps, I would definitely disagree with Michael there. By wasps, I presume he means those black and yellow stripy things that we see in the garden. That's just one of a few different kinds of wasps look like that. The vast majority of our wasps look nothing like that. We have many, many different species of parasitic wasps, and they do all sorts of important pollinating jobs. But they do control, in Ireland, even those yellow and black ones, they do control a huge amount of pest insects, like you said, Aina, especially aphids and so on. So they do have a role to play.
But do you not have any compunction about the morality of one species deciding another species shouldn't live?
Oh, absolutely.
Because they can't justify their existence.
What would the wasps say about humans? They say, what's the point of humans? They're just wrecking the place. You know, like, why do we need humans? We're all better off without the humans. I could see many species of animals.
I mean, Derek, you'll be making a programme. You'll be making a programme in 20 years' time, Back from the Brink with Mosquitoes.
Richard.
Derek, yes, this is a very ancient problem. It's known as the is-ought problem. The great philosopher who dealt with this was a fellow called David Hume, 18th century. And he made the famous statement, one cannot derive an ought from an is. It brings back a great memory. I've had this discussion in India. Barbara and I were travelling down through India in a train, taking about 12 hours or something. And we shared a compartment for four bunks with two Jains, a husband and wife Jains. The Jains are a sect that doesn't kill anything. They are opposed to killing anything. So I was there and there were mosquitoes buzzing around and it was steamy hot kind of a situation. So I started swatting the mosquitoes. And the man says to me, oh no, you must stop. You mustn't do that. So I said, but look, I might get malaria from them and die. But his attitude was, oh no, they have a right to exist as well. You mustn't kill them. So I had to desist from killing them. This is an extreme example of that. I remember in Varanasi, met a Brahmin, a man who was very highly educated. He was actually a microbiologist. This is the place where the bodies are burned and the ashes thrown into the Ganges. And people who can't afford the logs to burn their relatives throw the bodies into, at that time anyway, they threw the bodies into the Ganges without burning them. Now, I said to him, look, and the water looked like milky tea, you know, a brownies thing, you know. There's no smell of it. And I said, what's going on here? And I asked, how many sewage outfalls are there from a million people? And he says, oh, about 28. He says he worked in this area. And he says, why don't you stop the people from going in there and bathing it? There's a whole hundreds of people in the water, and they're filthy water. And he says, well, I go into the water myself, he said. Oh, my God. So I said, but look, you'll get cholera. This will kill you. Yes, and he said, I've already had cholera and typhoid, he said, do you see? And yet he goes in again and again. And he was a very articulate, educated man. And this is, his values were different from mine. I would no more go into that water for any reason. Now, I would think that the best compromise is to control these things, not eliminate them. We should avoid eliminating things. The is-ought problem resolves itself in that way. That is what I think we should do.
Yeah, well, I mean, lots of people don't like various types of wildlife, but if you were to take that to its extreme, then you would be
left.
Living in a desert, in a place where there's nothing, and then we'd be gone ourselves. I mean, people don't realise that we are actually part of a whole ecosystem. That if you start pulling pieces out and making them extinct, the whole, that's what biodiversity is all about. We're part of that. So, no, enjoy the programme and make sure that we're not looking in 20 years at wasps and mosquitoes coming back from the brink.
All right, so Michelle Brown, our researcher, has popped in with some of your communications. Michelle.
Okay, so Sylvia McGill was on. She was in Jouse Woods recently and she took a picture of a pine with red berries on it and she was amazed. They looked almost like raspberries and spent ages trying to research it and is wondering if it was Scots pine, which has red female flowers, but these were definitely berries and yellow male flowers and two needles joined at the base as described by Ian in a video talking about them.
Is it Joust or Jouse? What did you say?
Jouse Woods.
Where's that? Where's Jouse Woods?
So it's up in Wicklow. It's part of the Wicklow Way.
Never heard
D-J-O-U-C-E.
of it.
D-J-O-U-C-E. I told you should get out more.
No, go on.
Come on, I'll bring it for a walk afterwards. We'll go off to Jouse Woods. Anyway, the tree that she sent in a lovely picture of is actually not a pine tree at all. It is a noble fir, the ones that we all spend loads of money buying at Christmas time. And in the month of May, it puts out male catkins, which contain pollen, and the male catkins look like raspberries. So what she's calling berries are the male catkins. And they, once they shed the pollen, they lose all this red colour. So you only have this red-coloured berries that you see for about 2 or 3 weeks in May. So she was lucky to see them. Pollen comes out, wind-blown, onto the female parts. Cones are quite large and stand up. They're so heavy, in fact, they break over the tree. But the reason why it's there, it's obviously escaped from some Christmas tree farm down the road. It's not a native species at all, but it looks well. That's what it is, though.
And we have a picture of it for the website.
Yes, picture.
Right, so people can go rte.ie/Mooney.
Okay. I have another email. I love this one. It's from Lisa Quinlan. She said, hi, Derek. I took this photo of a bee who was fast asleep in one of my roses. He remained there for hours. He was just fine, just having a long nap.
It was a she.
Why do you say it's a she?
Because all the bees that do work are women, don't you know? The men only do the one thing and they certainly aren't going to flowers to be sleeping there all night. So this was a bumblebee in the flower and it obviously is a creature that is able to survive in colder conditions, so it didn't have to go back to its nest or anything. It was a fine big flower and it had finished work for the day, so she stayed there overnight and fair play to her. You could see the pollen baskets on her leg, which obviously means that it is a female, because the males, while they might visit for a bit of nectar for themselves, certainly aren't going to be carrying anything back to the nest or feeding any babies. You know yourself the way men are, they don't do that kind of thing.
No, they certainly don't be feeding babies anyway. Have you got another one, Michelle?
Yeah, there's two on the cuckoo actually.
Oh great, oh this is for Niall and Richard, okay. Go ahead.
Okay, so Mary Rose was on. I lived near Shalala in Wicklow and she heard a couple of male cuckoo in the woods in Wicklow Way for the last couple of years and she's wondering, are they looking for a female? And the second question is, my husband has been hearing the cuckoo for the last few weeks, especially at night. We're wondering if the nighttime call is unusual. Kind regards, Bernie.
So cuckoos calling or singing, that's a wonderful cuckoo song of the male. It really has one function, that is absolutely to try and attract in a female. In fact, in the case of the cuckoo, he doesn't just want one female, he wants as many as he can get. The cuckoo, of course, has the luxury, especially the male, of not really having to worry at all about his offspring after he's mated with the female. And he can afford to mate with as many as he possibly can, thereby passing on his genetic lineage to future generations. And that's him then, job done. So he wants to try and get that done as quickly as he can before all the females have been mated and are no longer receptive. And once that's happened, then they stop singing. So they will sing during the night. They will make that call sometimes, especially if they haven't maybe been terribly successful so far. He really would be quite frustrated wanting to get a female, but they'll do it as much as they possibly can.
So is he still holding territory if he's making that call? Because given that he's not building a nest and she's not building a nest, they're just mating and then going to lay the eggs in another nest, is he still holding territory?
He is, although cuckoos don't hold territory in the same way that most other birds do, because he's not looking to have a nesting area or anything like that. He wants to have a sort of performance stage where there aren't other male cuckoos directly competing with him. So cuckoos will get quite aggressive if they hear another male cuckoo singing too close to them, but it's not like he's trying to defend it for food resources for chicks or for a female to nest in or anything like that. So their breeding biology is very different to that of other birds.
Yeah, she said that she heard him calling in a woodland. I mean, don't they? Females lay their eggs in the meadowpipit's nest, which nests on the ground. So is it a waste of time being in a woodland?
No, you will get cuckoos in woodlands, because that doesn't mean that the female is going to actually nest or lay her eggs there. She doesn't build a nest, of course. It's a nice prominent location where the male can be found. So if he finds a nice tall tree and has a good sort of view over the landscape around him, his voice will project out from those trees. He will happily sing from the top of a tree. Then the female passing in, perhaps just arrived on migration, will hear him, and will then, if he's lucky, will then mate with him. She will then move on and she will lay a series of eggs in the nests of other birds when she finds her host species. In Ireland, it's very often the meadowpipit is the bird that she would go for.
Does she need to be mated each time, or can she lay all the eggs from one mating?
She will have usually multiple male matings, but she will store that sperm so she can actually fertilise multiple eggs with it. But there's competition among the males to try and be the one to father as many of her chicks as they possibly can. And they're in no way monogamous. There's no faithfulness there at all. They just mate. That's the job done. They go their separate ways, and he'll mate with as many females as he can.
Richard.
Yes, do you remember a dawn chorus we had out in Dick Warner's house, Andrew Wren, and a cuckoo sang brilliantly all night, or a lot of the night there. It was the best cuckoo we've had in the dawn chorus, in my recollection. Now, that's a good few years ago. But there's a mystery here. If he's trying to attract females, what is he doing shouting his head off at night? Now, what? There won't be any females, they'll all be asleep. Well, should be asleep. Maybe they go out and mate with males at night, perhaps. I do not know. The way they seem to work it is they have a home range rather than a territory. That's an area around which they will parade and call, and they are watching for the meadowpipits or their other host species, watching for them to choose their moment to move in. They're watching two dozen nests, and they're watching it slowly, and they don't want others to pop in, other cuckoos to pop in and remove their egg and dump their own. So I think that it is a rather complex system, but I would not describe them as lacking in territoriality. They have a home range rather than a narrow territory, and I think that is what happens there.
Yep, that's exactly it, Richard. That's right. And cuckoos are really fascinating because their breeding biology is so different from that of any other Irish bird. And it means that they're also very susceptible to declines in the populations of the host species, because the female will only lay her eggs in the nest of the same species that reared her. So if we're seeing declines in birds like meadowpipits, which we are, it remains a widespread species in Ireland, but it is declining, that has a knock-on effect on the number of cuckoos that are produced. It's harder for the female to find the eggs, and she has to absolutely lay those eggs. She's really under a lot of time pressure there. You even sometimes have a situation where a female cuckoo is sometimes just caught short. She can't find a nest, just has to dump her egg just in the open. It'll never hatch. But other than that, you know, she wouldn't survive if she wasn't able to do that. She just must lay that egg. So if she can't find enough of the host species, enough nests, then the cuckoo population really does decline as well. They're also very badly affected by the scarcity of their food in Ireland, which are hairy caterpillars. They eat the caterpillars of certain moth species. These hairs have a lot of irritants in them. They're very irritating to the throats and eyes of most creatures. They won't eat them, but cuckoos are able to swallow them. They have especially strengthened throats. They know how to skin these caterpillars as well. But when you have climate change affecting the emergence of these caterpillars, you have declines in vegetation, you have overuse of pesticides and too much pollution, it affects the moths, which then mean there are fewer caterpillars, which mean there are fewer cuckoos, and then it's a cycle, really. So it's a species that is declining, sadly.
What happened to the three? I mean, I know we ringed four of them last year. The one from Clare didn't survive, but the three from Kerry went off to Africa. They came back safely, did they?
They did. So that was part of a project that was been done by the National Parks and Wildlife Service in conjunction with the British Trust for Ornithology. We spoke about it last week on the programme with Sam Bailey from National Parks and Wildlife Service. And yes, there were four of these cuckoos tagged in Ireland last summer. One was tagged in the Burren and unfortunately never made it out of the Burren. It seems to have died in County Clare, which happens, of course. Cuckoos, you know, they don't have the longest of lives. But the three that were tagged in Killarney National Park, they did head off. They eventually, by different routes, arrived in sub-Saharan Africa, and then eventually all did return as well. So it's been really amazing to track the progress of those birds. Until now, we had no idea precisely where Irish cuckoos went to and the routes that they took. We could only guess, and it seems in many cases our guesses would have been wrong. One of those cuckoos did the most remarkable thing. When it left County Kerry, it headed straight for the Swiss Alps. You think it would just go straight down through France, down into Spain, maybe across to Morocco. It didn't. It went all the way to the Swiss Alps and from there to Bosnia, then down through Greece and into North Africa from there. Then went down, and they all end up around the Congo Basin eventually. One of the cuckoos, though, it seemed not to have, probably didn't get enough food. It wasn't doing terribly well. It went back on itself and spent several months just wandering around France well into October, which is pretty strange, but then made it down to Africa and then eventually made it back to Killarney. It's remarkable.
We made a documentary some years ago about the cuckoo, and that will be broadcast this time next week here on RT Radio 1 as we start our series of Second Chance to Hear. That is, Second Chance to Hear some of the documentaries from the Mooney Goes Wild archive. So if you're interested in cuckoos, you'll be very interested in that particular documentary. Do you want to say any more about this, Richard?
Yes, there's a debate going on among ornithologists of whether there's an accusation that since all the ornithologists are in the Northern Hemisphere, we have this top-down approach. We see us as being the natural home of the migrants, and they go down to Africa because they need a temporary stay down there. But it's argued by some that we should look at it the other way around and talk about the bottom-up view and say cuckoos and the like are naturally in Africa. That's their real home. And they only make excursions up here for surplus to breed sort of thing. So that bias probably helps to explain this fellow wandering all over the place, going to Bosnia and the Swiss Alps and the different routes they use. They come down and they come back through the middle of the... they come back to the west together. But most of them go down through the Sahara and Sahel. So it's an interesting thing that we are projecting our own preconceptions about what's going on onto the birds.
Certainly with the cuckoos, what we know from this tracking, they spend significantly more of their time in Africa than they do in Europe. And we also know that there are many other species of cuckoo closely related that spend all their time in Africa. They don't leave it at all. So it does seem very likely, or in fact almost certain, that the species has its origins in Africa and extended into Europe as a strategy. And so it has African origins. So though the young cuckoos may have come into the world in Ireland, they're certainly ancestry is Africa. But if you go back far enough, all of our ancestry is in Africa, because all of us human beings, our ancestors did exactly the same thing. And that's the beauty of nature, I think, that it's never quite as clear-cut or as straightforward as it might seem. I think with migrant birds, the way that they connect us to far-flung parts of the world, I think is really, really interesting and exciting. But we do, yeah, I think we are very Eurocentric in the way we look at things. When you look at swallows, for example, as well, it's the same story with swallows. Swallows, from an evolutionary point of view, are African birds that have extended their range into Europe rather than European birds that have gone to Africa.
I cannot let it go. We call the cuckoo, because it says cuckoo, cuckoo. And it only sings when it's mating. It doesn't sing, I presume, in the Congo. I wonder what they call it there.
That's absolutely. That's a very good question indeed. And they have.
Yeah, but it's a very good question. But give me a very good answer now. People are always saying things are very good questions when they don't know the answer.
I will check. Hang on. See if I can find you. Keep talking, and I'll do some checking.
I don't know what it's called in the Congo. I know in Africa. So there's many languages in Africa, but the countries often have a colonial power, whether it speak English or French. In both of those, it is cuckoo.
That's right, because we hear it singing, because it's mating, because it's here, it's where it's born and where it's from.
That's also a very Eurocentric approach.
Yeah, well, I know. But then what about the curlew? It's called after what it's called. What about the corncrake? We were speaking Latin, I do know crex. But, you know, the sound echoes, the name echoes the sound, isn't that what they say? Onomatopoeia, yeah.
But the thing is, of course, it's all about us humans trying to put order on. The birds and the other organisms have no idea what we call them, and they couldn't care even if they did know. It's our own attempt to put order on things and to classify things. There's nothing wrong with that, but we should remember that. I mean, I have no idea, but in Greenland, where the Greenland white-fronted geese come from, what do the Inuit people call them? I'm not sure, but I bet it's not Greenland white-fronted goose.
I wish it had had, if Linnaeus came from South Africa, the world would have been in a completely different place from point of view of wildlife names. What do you think?
Yes, absolutely. So, again, Eurocentric.
Look at the map of the world. And what you see is most of the land is in the north. And most of that land, a lot of it, was covered by ice until 10 or 12,000 years ago. It was inaccessible. So the focus then was Africa. Africa was home to everything. Then the ice retreated and meant that a huge geographical area, far bigger than what the southern hemisphere has to offer, opened up. And the birds then moving in to cash in on that, do you see? So again, it favours the bottom-up model. They're all down there and this ice is going off. 2 million years we had various ice ages coming and going. So Africa was a sort of stable place. I'm just arguing from the African point of view.
Did you find the name, Derek?
It says cuckoo. It's spelled differently. I don't speak French. You speak French? A little bit of French? C-O-U-C-O-U.
That's the French for cuckoo, yeah. Cuckoo,
yeah, cuckoo, cuckoo. Yeah. So that's what's come up. So perhaps it's called the cuckoo.
That's only for the French people.
I know,
the French speaking people there. I mean, you don't expect an answer from Google now, come on.
The thing is that there are many, many other species of cuckoo in the world. Only one of them are Eurasian or European cuckoo, actually goes cuckoo. And all the other cuckoo species that make completely different sounds, they're all named after our cuckoo as well, even though they don't make that sound. So they should be miffed if that's the case.
Oh, we could have a whole programme on this. Join us for next week's thrilling instalment.
Anyway, enough about cuckoos for the moment. We can look forward to that documentary next week. Now, Aina, you mentioned at the top of the programme that last Monday was International Bee Day. We've had the Dawn Chorus. We should have perhaps had a live Bee Day chorus as well.
Well, birds and
we're
the bees.
We're mentioning it. We are celebrating it.
Birds and the bees equally important, and we're celebrating it today, if
yes,
you like.
We are.
Because thinking back to Michael's email there about exterminating mosquitoes.
Yeah,
and
just to remind
wasps,
people, you've just listened to us back from the Brink Finish last Sunday, and we had an email from one of our listeners saying he very much enjoyed the programme, but is there an argument for preserving the likes, or could we make one for preserving the likes of mosquitoes and wasps, etc.?
Yeah, this goes back to a lack of understanding of the role of each species that has evolved to have a vital part to play in the stable ecosystem. And, you know, we have to be interested in the first place, and once this interest is awakened, then we can really want to conserve all our fellow species. But we have to actually be interested, and how do you get people interested in the first place? So in a moment we're going to be hearing an interview I recorded earlier there with Aoife Ní Gile Ó Cuadhe, who is the owner of Gaelti Honey Farm and the co-founder of the Native Irish Honey Bee Society.
Yeah.
Now, while she makes her living from honey and honeybees, nonetheless,
she has a vested interest in.
Well, she has a vested interest indeed, but I mean, to have such a successful honeybee farm of Native Irish honeybees, 170 hives, she must be doing something right, and she is, and she has the whole environment suitable for this. And if it's suitable for the honeybees, it's suitable for all the other co-fellow travellers that we have in that area as well, who are also pollinators, who also feed on nectar, who also want pollen and things like this. So it's wakening up the interest of people in the wildlife in the first place. If people were as interested as they should be, we wouldn't be having this pushing the stone up a hill trying to get people to conserve biodiversity. You know, when people say to you, you know, when did you get interested in wildlife? Oh, last week when Derek said he'd want to be on the programme. You know, yeah. I mean, we all are interested in wildlife to begin with as kids. It's just that we're told, stop touching that, don't be poking at that, and it's bad out of us. But, you know, we should conserve this interest that we have ourselves in wildlife. It's not something odd and a peculiar programme that's on late at night for vested interests. This is something that is of importance to everybody, and the more we're interested in it, then the more we wanted to be there. So it was great to have this interview with Aoife, who was hugely enthusiastic about her native honeybees. Aoife, you're the owner of Galtee Honey Farm and you're the co-founder of the Native Irish Honeybee Society. It's great to be talking to you. Now, you come from a long line of beekeepers. Your father was a beekeeper, his uncle was a beekeeper. It's been in the family for a very long time, has it not?
That's right, Anna. Yeah, yeah. And actually, my father, his uncle's a beekeeper, but my father's father was a beekeeper as well, and his grandfather. So, yeah, it goes back further generations than that, but we can't, you know, trace the generations beyond that, you know.
So you, of course, then are very familiar and used to the tradition of telling the bees when somebody dies. Now, your mother, Joan, yes. I'm sorry to hear, died recently, but you informed the bees.
Thanks.
Of this. Tell us how you told the bees.
We did. So, yeah, it was a very special event. We were devastated when my mother passed, but the first thing my father said straight away, we need to go out and tell the bees. So he gathered us up and we went out to one of the hives, and you only have to tell one hive of bees, because those bees in that hive will go around to the other hives and tell the other bees. So the tradition is, like, this was carried out when his father died as well, and he remembers it, his uncle doing it, and the previous generation. So what you do is you bring a black cloth with you, preferably black crepe, but any black cloth will do. We had a black scarf belonged to my mother, and he draped it over the top of the hive. And then it's really important to bring some food and drink from the wake, and you put it on top of the black cloth as an offering to the bees. And you tell the bees then that the person has passed. And he had a lovely poem at the time. So you can just tell them, you don't have to recite a poem, but he had a lovely poem. It's called Telling the Bees. It's a very old Scottish poem, and he recited that. And it was lovely because it suited the situation so well, because in the poem, after every line, you know, he said, bees, bees murmuring low, bees, bees murmuring low. And it just really suited the occasion.
Yeah, we have a clip of this actually, Aoife, and we can have a listen to it.
Wished little bees sad tidings I bear. Bees, bees murmuring low, howled in her grave lies your mistress dear. Bees, bees murmuring low, no more she'll ride to the sound of the horn, no more she'll tickle her sickle for corn, no more she'll come to your hive of a morn. Look, honey bees.
Yeah, tradition is really very important to keep it going.
Yes.
You're in the Galtee Honey Farm and you have 170 hives of native Irish black honey bees, which is great.
That's right.
Yeah, but I'm just wondering, for the benefit of people, you know, we're talking about the native Irish black honey bee becoming endangered. And
yes,
sometimes people think this is just because of climate change and biodiversity lacking and all of that. But it's also because of the introduction of the buckfast bee, which is a different bee altogether. Can you explain why this?
That's
buckfast,
right.
What's going on? I mean, people don't realise that it's not so much the Irish bees are becoming extinct because of all the environmental issues. There's this extra thing that we never talk about. Tell me about this.
Yeah, that's right. So unfortunately, the native Irish black honeybee, it's also called the dark European honeybee, and it was once native to all of Europe north of the Alps, you know, northern and northwestern Europe. It only exists in small pockets now in mainland Europe. It's virtually extinct in mainland Europe. Ireland has the largest populations in the world of this bee, this honeybee. And we know that from DNA research that has been carried out by LIT and NUIG. They did extensive surveys. And, you know, so it's great because we have something really special. We have a really special genetic resource here in Ireland. But the problem is, it is under threat from importations, as you mentioned, of the Buckfast honeybee. So this honeybee was created back in the kind of by Brother Adam from Buckfast Abbey, over 100 years ago now. But at the time, it was declared by him that the black bees of the British Isles had become extinct. There was a disease at the time called the Isle of Wight disease that wiped out huge populations of black bees in Britain and Ireland. But they weren't all wiped out, and thankfully, we know that now from the DNA evidence that we have. So, the importation of these Buckfast bees, and they're actually being reared here in Ireland. When they mate with the native black honeybees, the next generation is a hybrid, and the genetics of our rare native black bee are lost then, you know, which is very unfortunate. A lot of beekeepers keep the native black honeybee because of its advantages in our Irish climate. So, you know, it evolved with our Irish summer weather. So, for example, if you had in the summertime, like we often do have in an Irish summer, we might have a week or two of beautiful warm weather where the bees can collect as much as they can. And then you might have another week or two of rain, and they can't get out to collect nectar and pollen at all. So our native black honeybees have evolved to hold on to what they've collected and not eat through it. You know, they're very frugal with their stores, and they'll survive on very little. So that's a really good advantage, you can imagine, in our Irish summers.
170 hives of bees is a queer amount of bees. And it was actually it was actually with yourselves down in the Galtee Bee Farm that our late Philip McCabe, Beard of the World of Bees, world record attempt, way back, it was
2005.
That's what I'm just trying to say. It's practically 20 years ago since it happened. Do you remember that? Or can you tell us about it?
He was so brave.
So what happened? I mean, was this lined up for ages? Had you all loads of bees got in from extra places?
Give us the
background information. How did it all happen?
Okay. Yeah. Oh, it was, I mean, I still remember it like it was yesterday, because it was such a vivid, crazy, unusual event that it's something you'll never forget, you know. So I think they had it in the planning for about for the year previous to that. And I remember at the time my father, Hall. So this area here is the base for Galtee Bee Breeding Group. It was the first conservation area for the native Irish black honeybee. And basically, we all got together to carry out this world record attempt with Philip, who was so brave at the time, because no one else would have done that, I don't think. I honestly don't think. But what we did was, the night before we to collect the bees, we went around to our colonies here in Galtee Honey Farm. So, to collect the amount of bees, you would have to take, we took roughly 10,000 from each hive, and we did about 20, 30 hives. We selected our most docile colonies. That was really important, so that Philip would get as little stings as possible. So the thing with honeybees is they do not like being without their queen. So that was what they did. We collected them the night before and left them without their queen bee. And because of this, then the following morning, when Philip got up on the weighing scales on the white sheet to start the world record attempt, these bees had been queenless for many hours, and we just poured them at his feet. And we also had tied a queen bee in a cage around his neck, just in a little box. So once we poured the bees out, as soon as they got the smell of the queen bee around Philip's neck, they started swarming up his body. They basically thought that Philip was like one giant queen bee. And that's how we got them all over his body.
Yes, indeed. We have a clip of Philip McCabe and Dick Warner in 2005 talking about this whole event. Let's have a listen.
They're going to pour 500,000 bees onto me in aid of Bohor. We're promoting the Appamundia Congress that's taking place in August, the World Beekeeping Congress. And in order to do it, we thought we'd raise a few pounds for Bohor into the bargain. So today we have a load of people here, all dressed in bee suits, I hasten to add. These bees will pour the bees. I mean, the Gatti Bee Breeding Group, who are the local beekeeping group down here, they have bred bees, and they're now going to pour them onto me, onto my naked body. And if we pass 87.5 pound weight, it means I'm into the Guinness Book of Records, and that's what it's all about.
So, Philip, how many bees are we talking about?
Well, we're talking between 400,000 and 500,000.
And how do you count them?
Yeah, by weight. There's so many bees. There's 4,000 bees in a pound weight.
Now, you're mad into honeybees. What's the story on bumblebees? I had somebody asking me the other day, all you people with honeybees are taking the bite out of the mouths of the bumblebees, and the more honeybees there are, this is why we've no bumblebees. Mind you, they left with a flea in their ear after they told that to me, as if it was people with honeybees that were causing the demise of bumblebees. Yeah. Nothing to do with biodiversity change. But I mean, Harry, you have a bumblebee that's a friend of yours, I believe.
That's right, yeah. So, I mean, the honeybees, and again, as a beekeeper, most beekeepers are extremely conscious of the other bees, the solitary bees and the bumblebees. And I can talk a little bit about that in a minute, if you like. But we had this beautiful bumblebee at one time. So, we have 20 apiary sites where our 170 hives of bees are sited. So we would have like about 8 hives in each site, not too many. So that's number one, they're not competing with each other, but also they're not competing with bumblebees or solitary bees or other pollinators in the area, because beekeepers would be conscious of that. And again, you're completely right there. It's actually the reduction in biodiversity that is causing most of the problem with the decline of our pollinators. But there was this bumblebee, so like in around the apiaries and around where our honey farm is, there's lots of wild sites. That's so important for all pollinators. So you'll have lots of briars, clumps of briars in areas, and you'll have tufts of grass, and you'll have all sorts of things. So we do see bumblebee nests quite a bit, and they live side by side with the honeybee hives, which is great. But I had this 1 year when we were extracting the honey after harvesting it, every day at lunchtime when I'd come out of the honey house, there'd be a little bumblebee waiting for a little sup of nectar. So how it started was that she got into the honey house first on the first day, and I had to hunt the poor thing out. I just picked her up and put her outside. This was at lunchtime, and I gave her a little sup of nectar. And the following day, when I came out for my lunch, there she was hovering around the door of the honey house again, waiting. So I got a little spoon, gave her a little sup of our own nectar, and she did that for a couple of weeks every day. And I was confident that I could give her own nectar because it's our own honey. I can stand over its traceability, but I wouldn't recommend people buying honey off the shop shelf and feeding it to bumblebees at all, because, you know, generally what they can get in their environment is the healthiest for them, just in case you'd pass a disease onto them.
And you're dead sure it was the same bumblebee all the time, not a sister that came one day and another sister. Did they live for? I mean, how long do bumblebees live for, indeed?
Yeah. I think I'm fairly certain it was the same one, but you never know. Yeah,
of course it was.
She could have told her sisters. Yeah.
We were talking there earlier on about conserving things and making things not be extinct and back from the brink and all of this. But it all really boils down to people having an interest in the world around them and trying to get people interested because you're not interested in what's going on. If you don't notice it, if you don't see it, how can you even get to the next step of preserving it, of conserving it, of making the environment suitable for the creatures you want to conserve? I mean, I'm listening to you there now and I can hear the bees all around you. So presumably where you're standing, yeah, there's lots and lots of bees that are actually going about their daily business, coming and going, because the habitat where you are has the requisite flowers and plants. Do you plant some or are they all wild?
We do plant. We do plant bee plants in our garden and that. But like, what's out in the countryside is the most important thing for the honeybees and all pollinators. So again, it goes back to our biodiversity. You know, 95% of what they collect is the condition of the environment. Like the hedgerows are lifelines of the honeybees and the pollinators. And like, for example, with honeybees, their number one most important wildflower is from the briars. It's just the humble bramble, or the briars, the blackberry blossom. And if they don't have enough wild areas in the environment where the brambles are allowed to grow, for example, through the hedgerows and areas like that, you know, in also field margins, you know, those areas, you know, they're not going to produce as much honey for themselves, and let alone for whoever's looking after them. That's secondary. It's to keep themselves alive is really important. But again, in saying that, you know, there are a lot of flowers and plants you can plant for pollinators. And you know, especially like there are hundreds of them. I have a whole chart of them, you know, that you can plant. And if you know, there's some wonderful books. There's a book called Plants for Bees, published by the International Bee Research
Association. Yes, indeed. And we have the whole National Pollinator Plan as well. But listen,
yes,
tell me finally, what would you say to the people who want to be getting rid of this, that and the other? What would a world be like with no bees, no wasps, none of these pollinating insects? Can you imagine such a thing?
Yeah, it would. It would be a very different world. Very different world, because a third of the food that we eat has had something to do with a bee. So, you know, we'd have a huge reduction in the amount of foods and the amount of choice we have, especially in countries where pollination is essential for, you know, like orange production and almond production. In California, they're in an awful lot of trouble at times because they're locked in to the whole pollination process economically so much. But as well, like, I just think that sometimes people think, oh, this means we should get a hive of bees to look after the bees, but it's something we don't encourage people to do unless they're going to do it the right way. For example, if you get the wrong type of honeybees, like buckfast bees, because you haven't done your research, you could be doing more harm than good for the native honeybee populations. Also, I suppose the honeybees are not in danger the same way that the bumblebees and solitary bees are, because they rely completely on their environment, because they live in the wild, so their habitats are those wild areas. So the best thing you can do for bees is to make your environment pollinator friendly as much as possible.
Well, you're a great advocate for bees, I have to say. I'm off to have some bread and honey now. In fact, even the owl and the pussycat liked it. Do you remember the thing? The owl and the pussycat. The owl and the pussycat went to sea in a beautiful pea green boat. They brought some honey and plenty of money wrapped up in a £5 note.
£5 note. They had their priorities right.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed. Okay. Good to talk to you, Aoife.
Good to talk to you too, Aoife. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much indeed, Aoife and Aoife. Now we're joined in the studio by Terry Flanagan. It was a bit of a hazy day yesterday. Terence, I was working with you and you said you love the rain. You love it when it's like this.
Well, I don't love the rain per se, but I do think it's very good for us, because one of the things about the rain is that we see those lovely green colours here in Ireland. You know, when you go to Spain and it hasn't rained for weeks and weeks, maybe months and months, and everything is
looks
brown.
Burnt, yeah.
You go out here this morning and you have a look, And you look at all those colours. May is the month of green and white. We see all those lovely white flowers, the elderberries, the chestnuts that are just finished, the cow parsleys, and then you have the greens. And you know what they say about Ireland? You've got the 40 shades of green. And
yes, certainly have, yeah.
You've got really 40. At the moment, I'm looking at trees like lime trees, and they've got that beautiful colour, that really fresh green colour. And of course, as we go on into June and July and August, that will fade. I actually prefer May. May is my favourite month in the year, and that's the reason why. It's because of the colours. I know we've got all that fantastic bird song, we've got the dawn chorus as well, but what I really like is I like the colours. When you're out for a walk, I go down the canal and you can see, oh, it's just magical. The swans are on the canal at the moment, the ducks, they've got the ducklings there. But those colours, that's what brings it all home in May.
Now, we just heard a clip of the late Philip McCabe and indeed Dick Warner, my old boss and mate, and how sadly missed they are. You were there that day with Philip when he went for that world record breaking attempt.
Yeah, I'll never forget it, Derek. The reason why I remember it, first of all, is because it was my birthday. It was the 25th of June, 2005. And I went down with Angela and we spent the day down there watching this event and reporting on it. And it was an incredible event. First thing I did was I got suited up, booted and suited. And Philip was laughing at me, look, with this big gear on top of me. I was like the Michelin man. And he was there and he had nothing on. A pair of underpants he'd on. He had a pair of underpants on. He had a pair of earplugs in his ears and he had a pair of nose plugs in his nose. And that was it. And they taped up this queen bee onto his chest. And then they started pouring, literally pouring all of these bees onto his body. He had a back brace to support him. He reckoned, or he was hoping, that he would get 100 pounds of bees on his body. And it went on and on and on. The day, actually, Derek, was a bit like yesterday. It was a bit of a kind of a hazy day. It wasn't as warm as they had hoped to be. So things kind of slowed up in placing the bees on his body. And he got tired, and I think the bees may have got a bit agitated. Look, sadly, he didn't break the record, but it was a fantastic day, and it was great to see him. And I remember at the very end when they were scooping all of the bees off him, and they were just taking them off in bucket loads. It was incredible to watch. And then he jumped off the scales. And I said to him, the first thing I said, did you get stung? And he said, I'm just after getting stung there now. I said, I must have frightened one of those bees. That was the only it was the only sting he got. And he, I don't know, 100,000 or 200,000 bees in his body.
Oh,
it was a great day.
Fantastic guy, Philip. He really was.
They're sadly missed.
Absolutely.
And Dick as well. Dick worked here on the programme. So Dick was a gentleman.
I was off that time, which is why Dick was sitting and presenting, because he was the original producer of Mooney Goes Wild. Anyway, let's move on with today, Terence.
Well, we're still on the theme of
insects.
The social insects. We had an email in from Aileen Donahar McGowan. She had a number of insects coming into her house and she wondered what they were. She even sent over some photographs. Well, as you know, Derek, insects are the most common species of organisms on Earth and they can be very, very difficult to identify. But thankfully, there's a group here in Ireland. They're called Invertebrates and Insects Ireland and they can help. One of their experts is Dr. Hugh Feely, and I met up with him one day last week and showed him Aileen's photos.
We'd know this one, so this would be one of the mining bees. I think the name is Andrea Scotta.
Is it a common one?
Mostly found eastern the country, I think, and you can usually tell it because its legs are all and its abdomen are all black. Sometimes it's called the chocolate mining bee for that reason.
When Aileen sent in these photographs to us too, she wanted to know, first of all, is it a bee or a wasp? It's quite difficult to tell from that, isn't it? It's not like your common bee.
No, so this would be what they call a solitary bee, and it wouldn't live in a hive or a nest. But you'll find them generally all through early spring and through the summer. This species, for example, would be around generally from March to July.
Mm-hmm. Now, they're mining bees. I presume then they mine or they have their nests in the ground.
Yeah, so they'd like kind of sandy soils, that kind of habitat, and they would burrow in and that would be where their nest is. So you'd often find them near paths or areas that are worn away or eroded.
So going back then to Aileen, her insect is a mining bee. Fairly common and nothing to worry about.
Oh, absolutely nothing to worry about. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Hugh Feely talking with our own Terry Flanagan. Terry.
Yes, from Invertebrates and Insects of Ireland. And it's a place that you should get onto if you're stuck to find out what a particular insect is, and details can be found on our website.
rte.ie/Mooney. Now, just to look ahead to Nature on One next Monday here on RTE Radio 1 from 3 o'clock. That's our series of features and documentaries. It's all about Mooney Talks. That's a series of lectures given at University College Cork last May. They were recorded and will be broadcast and released on podcast during the summer. But just to whet your appetite, we've put together a 50-minute feature encompassing extracts from all of the talks. Now, there were 9 people in total. Everything from the possible return of dinosaurs to our understanding of bird migration to the wonder of poo. That was Terry Flanagan's chosen subject. Very quickly, Terry, on the spot, tell me one very interesting thing about poo.
At one time, poo was the most expensive commodity on earth.
Really?
Yes, absolutely.
To find out more, listen to Mooney Talks next week. That's all we have time for. My thanks to Terry Flanagan, Enid Lana, Niall Hatch and Richard Collins. Our broadcast coordinator is Daniel Keating and our researcher is Michelle Brown. rte.ie/Mooney. Until next week, Monday at 3 p.m. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye.